let's come back and let's understand. In the ecology of consciousness, there are a pair of forms, like there are a pair of forms in the cycle of nature. In nature, the forms are phenomenal as existential and as mental. Mental forms are phenomenal. One can have, literally, ideas that can be given architecture just like a phenomenal existential thing, or as ritual existential actions. You can stage the actions. The actions will have a karma, will have an effect. They will have a causality. They will link. And those existential forms will have a referentiality to the point that one can identify the one by the other, either way. In the ecology of consciousness, there are also four dimensions, but they are differential. They work the other way. They do not work by identification, but by resonance. And the resonance is according to ratios, according to proportions. So that the arts and sciences are two kinds of conscious forms. And ever since the Renaissance 500 years ago, the arts and sciences have always been tuned together in the transform of the universities. In the medieval universities, they were based on a natural cycle of ritual and mental forms making little alignments of identification. And so medieval universities did it medieval ways, but the Renaissance universities transformed all of that, and the arts and sciences were put together so that you will find Renaissance style universities all over the world, which will have buildings, the buildings for the arts and sciences, or the College of Arts and Sciences. You can check and cross-check in harmonic, calibrated resonances and ratios and proportions to find out if you are right. It will not only check out in terms now of not just identification, but in terms of truth. And concomitantly in terms of beauty. And concomitantly in terms of wisdom. What will become not only apparent, but beholdable, will have a beauty, it will have a truth, it will have a wisdom. It will have Athena's wisdom, it will have Aphrodite's beauty, it will have the truth of Aries, not to terrify, but for victory. And those three were all held together like a triangle by Apollo. And when Apollo held them together, the spectrum of all three of those together made 3 times 3, 3 cubed, 3 raised to a third level. And so if you had the 3 times 3 meant 9, and so the harmonic resonant matrix of Apollo was a perfect 10, having him as the background for the 9 muses. So that an Apollonian harp has 9 strings, whereas the mythic Orphic harp had 7 strings. Apollo is not so much the 10th as at the top, but is the dimension of all nine together as a distributed gestalt that now has a resonant set of being ordered. And the original way in which that nine was presented in its nascent quality was to have 10 dots, one dot at the top, then two dots in the second line, three dots in a third line, and four dots in a fourth line. And that triangle was called the Tetrachus. It was Pythagoras, about 2500 BC. From 2500 BC to 1500 AD is 2,000 years. It is an aeon. It is a double millennium. And so Apollo and the Nine Muses becomes a proportional harmonic ratioing in the Renaissance that enlarges the capacity for art and for science. The arts were conspicuous, but the sciences not so far behind. Let's look for just a moment at something which is little known and yet is immensely significant in terms of archaeology, architecture, and spiritual history, which recalibrates for all time, once we understand it, the entire order of civilization. This is from the west of England. This was excavated. And the site is called the Shrine of Apollo at Nettleton, Wiltshire. And this is the excavation monograph, archaeological report of the research committee of the Society of Antiquarians of London, number 40, published in 1982 by the Society of Antiquarians of London. The Shrine of Apollo. And this is supposed to be Apollo. It is not Apollo. When one looks at the iconography, not only of this discovered mask, but at the very architecture of the original temple, one comes with the kind of maturing that is going on here to have the ability to behold that a conscious art form has a distinctly different kind of symmetry from a natural cycle craft form. Natural cycle craft forms will always have compare and contrast, parallels and obliques, and it will have that kind of a symmetry. If you have a plus one, you can have a negative one. When conscious dimensions come into play, the symmetry is rotational. And the all-time beginning form of that is the hand. The five fingers of the hand, four fingers and a thumb. And it helps then to understand that the rotation like this can also be expressed as a star. And so the star as a motif is particularly an archetypal symbol of consciousness. When one uses the term of finding the radiance of one's inner star, it's not just hyperbole. It's an actuality. But the radiance will be in a rotational double chirality. the form that recommends itself most for that is actually a wheel. And one can indeed make buildings in the shape of the wheel, but the traditional way was to shape the buildings in octagons. That the octagon, the eight-sided building, then was considered to be a rotational symmetry, and the main temple at Nettleton was actually in an octagonal form for very good reason, as we will see. The dedication that was found there was stippled onto the top of this, and it looked like it read Apollo, A-P-O-L, and underneath it was Decimus. The peculiar thing is that in looking at not esoteric history, but looking at kaleidoscopic conscious history and recalibrating, one can come to understand that it doesn't read that this is the temple of Apollo at all. This entire complex was a healing complex and eventually became very large and is still used 2,000 years later by thousands of pilgrims who actually come and are cured there. It's not very far off the Wiltshire Plain where you have Stonehenge and Avebury, and it's not only an ancient sacred ground, but this place in particular was a burial site of one of the most remarkable women who has ever lived. The A has a dot after it, which means that it's an initial A. And the P-O-L so is different, so that was a Roman name. And the Roman name was Asinius Pollio. And Asinius Pollio is in the fourth eclogue of Virgil. Virgil, who wrote the national epic for the Roman Empire, the Aeneid. His first visionary bucolic poems are called the eclogues, and the fourth is always called the messianic eclogue. Virgil died in 19 BC, but he was always considered to be one of the prophets of the birth of Christ because of this eclogue. That's why Dante chose him to be his guide in the Divine Comedy for two-thirds of the journey. Sicilian muses, come, let us attempt. A somewhat grander theme. Not everybody has a taste for thickets and humble tamarisks. If we sing of woods, let them be counselor. Let it be the big woods. Foretold by Sibylline song, the crowning age has arrived. The great cycle of the centuries begins afresh. Justice the Virgin returns balance. The happy reign of Saturn is restored, and a new child is being sent down from heaven. This was written about 45 BC. With him, the people of the age of iron shall die out, and thenceforth, all over the world, a golden race will arise. Chaste goddess of birth, smile on the babe. Now your brother Apollo reigns. And it's under you as counsel, Pollio, that this radiance will dawn and the procession of glorious months begin on their onward march. The big competitor to Virgil was Ovid. And his epic was called the Metamorphoses. The Aeneid was modeled on Homer. The Metamorphoses was original with Ovid. And when you look at the epic of the Metamorphosis, it's 15 books, and the first book is about the four ages, each one lasting 500 years, each one being a cycle of the phoenix, and that when they're paired, they make a millennium, and when they're paired, it makes a double millennium called an aeon, and that is the true cycle. The first 500 years is an age of gold, then there's 500 years as an age of silver, poets of the Silver Age. The third is 500 years of bronze, then 500 years of iron, where everything becomes iron-like, stodgy, eventually rusty, not particularly valuable at all. And all of a sudden, a new age of gold replaces the last corruption of the rust of the dead iron. Because when the time form is over, the new time form is what is viable in terms of actuality in nature and in terms of radiance, in terms of consciousness. The great little monograph, I brought it last week and I'll bring it again in a couple of weeks, on the place of Asinius Pollio was done by a novelist, Faith Baldwin, when she was a university student. This mask is feminine. It is not masculine. It's not of Apollo. This woman's name was Anna, and she is significant. Her mother's name was Susanna, and Susanna was one of the youngest of the four sisters of Jesus. And the husband of Susanna was Joseph of Arimathea, one of the richest men in the world at that time. His company, which ran out of the Mediterranean seaport of Tyre, went all the way across the Atlantic to the site that is now Marseille, up the Rhone River, as far as a little tributary that goes off to the west, where is now Sainte-Marie-Église, and just over one little ridge from there is another little tributary that leads down to the Loire River that goes all the way up through France and curves around through Brittany to the Atlantic Ocean. So that without having to go very much into the Atlantic Ocean with its weather and swells and navigational difficulties, one can go from the Phoenician coast of Tyre, which is only about 40 miles from Galilee, all the way to the Atlantic coast of France, Brittany it's called, because the people there are related to the ancient Britons. They're the same ancient tribe, the Belgae, they were called. And the west of Britain at the time was still British, was not yet Roman, hadn't been conquered by the Romans. And the center of that whole ecology was the Irish Sea. And all of the shores of the Irish Sea formed a pattern, a constellation of kingdoms that were interbred and intermarried for thousands of years. There was Ireland, southern Scotland, Wales, and the west of Britain, Cornwall and Somerset especially, and Devon occasionally in it. This woman was the daughter of Joseph of Arimathea and Jesus' sister Susanna, and she was the last person to be born in Israel while Jesus was still alive. The son of Joseph of Arimathea and Susanna was born in Britain, and his name was also Joseph. And through him come a whole line of British royalty. Jesus' family is not in France. It's in the west of Britain. This mask is feminine in a very special way. She harkens back to the messianic eclogue of Virgil at that time, because when she went to the west of Britain, all four of Jesus' sisters and their four husbands, and Lazarus and his sister Martha, and Nicodemus, who helped Joseph of Arimathea take Jesus down from the cross, plus Anna. And when they got there, each one of them received a hide, which was a land grant. I talked about that last week, of how my particular family 200 years ago got a sheepskin land grant to Illinois when it was still Indian territory. And my family founded West Union, Illinois, on the west bank of the Wabash as one of the first towns in what became the state of Illinois. About 20 miles from us is where Lincoln built a log cabin for his father. These 12 hides together were a patchwork of land that seasonally were islands in a very shallow lake. And as the seasons went out of the rainy season and into the summer, the lake beds would dry up and the land would be contiguous, and these would be not islands but hills. And there were seven of them. And on one of the hills' slope was built the first Christian community in the world. The church that occupied that site is called Glastonbury. Glastonbury, actually in the correct pronunciation of the ancient Celtic, turns out to be Apple Island. It's the Avalon of the Arthurian epic cycle. King Arthur, when he died in 540 AD, was buried at the entrance to the great circle of the original meditation areas. And he and Guinevere were buried in the same tomb together as a tombed pair. And what was found there, and I'll bring it next week, is an artifact that says this is Arthur, King of Britain, in his eternal rightful resting place, because one can follow the generations from the Holy Family all the way to King Arthur, name by name by name. They're all descendants, so that all of the members of the Knights of the Round Table were members of descendants of the Holy Family. Anna married the King of Cornwall. His name was Balliol, M-A-W-R. We have a female university in the United States, Bryn Mawr. Well, King Balliol was one of the most powerful independent British kings. This is long before there were Angles and Saxons and Normans and even Romans. This goes back to the ancient lineage to which Stonehenge belongs, and 1,000 years before Stonehenge, in Ireland, the earliest temple is called Newgrange. It was built in 3200 BC. It was built 700 years before the Great Pyramids was built. It was built in such a way that the midwinter sunrise would come up and shine rays of the winter solstice sun through the top of a special passage that went up and then angled and then was flat. And in this upper flat way, the rays of the sun would penetrate this enormous dome, sod covered and then planted with trees, so that it looked like a geometric hillock, but the passage went all the way to the center of the earth dome, and illuminated a triple spiral, a Celtic tri-spiral, to show that this had been built understanding the cycle of the year. And not only the cycle of the year, but oriented so that later refinements were able to take it not only this year and all the years that we know about, but that there is a slow but steady shifting of the way in which that cycle registers. And when one finally gets the entirety of that cycle, one comes out with an enormous block of time. The first people to try to find what time cycle it was were the Babylonians. And the Babylonians in what is today the Baghdad area tried mightily to find a way to calibrate what is this natural cycle, and they chose the constellation of stars that had become almost consistent by that time. We're talking about before 2000 BC, and that these would be then the motion of the sun through these constellations, which numbered 12, so that this would be an astrological zodiac of this great year, and that the sun would then move through these once every 1,000 years, once every millennium, and the 12 together would be the great year. This proved to be very, very difficult to sustain once mathematics was evolved to the level of Pythagoras, in which case it was realized that it actually takes a double millennium to go through an astrological zodiacal sign. So that instead of being a 12,000 year, it was actually more like a 24,000 year cycle to be the great year. But by the time of Plato, mathematics had been refined enough that it was quite a bit more than that. It was 25,590 years by the time of Plato, around 380 BC. Things were getting very refined. In 367 BC, a young man came to study with Plato named Aristotle, and he spent 20 years there and got really refined about how you do these things. And one of his great students was named Euclid, who founded the mathematical science of geometry. We still can use it as a textbook. Once you're accurate, the accuracy rings true. The forms are beautiful because one can come to understand, and they are wisdom because one can count on it. One can trust this. One can trust in truth and beauty. And with wisdom, or as Pythagoras said, the love of wisdom, the philosophia, once philosophy has the double chirality of truth and beauty, the beauty of the art and the truth of the science, now whatever transforms are made to enrich nature and the natural cycle, they will hold. The description of this octagonal building: in plan, the building resembled an octagonal cartwheel. The radial walls representing the spokes and the central shrine, the hub. The outer octagonal wall was encompassed by the surrounding stone platform or podium of the former building, and its outer wall was built up to form a covered, open-sided, colonnaded veranda. The columns and angle pilasters on octagonal retaining wall and the octagonal wall of the new building to form an ambulatory or covered walk surrounding the new building. The overall diameter of the octagonal temple, including the outer remaining wall and ambulatory, was 70 feet, 21.3 meters. the enormous complex of dozens of buildings that accompanied this was that this was a healing center, because not only was Anna a bona fide niece of Jesus, of his family, she was the only female niece. All of the children of those four sisters were males except for Anna. She was the only female, which meant that the mitochondrial DNA was only transmittable through her. Her cousins were St. James and St. John, St. Mark, as it turns out, through the mother's relations, St. Matthew, St. James the Less, so that almost all of the members had a family relational. The husband of the sister Mary, who was the mother of St. Mark, Cleophas had two brothers. One was Barnabas, who was a part of the great Mediterranean shipping empire, and he ran the family concerns on Cyprus. Barnabas is the one who went to fetch the repentant St. Paul from Tarsus and took him to Antioch after 14 years, and St. Paul's first missionary journey was to go with Barnabas, and Barnabas's nephew, St. Mark, John Mark, to go with Paul. And John Mark did not like what he found in Paul, and Barnabas did not find what Paul did offending John Mark. John Mark went back. He refused to go on, and Barnabas did not go on at all. But they had a third brother, an older brother. His name was Aristobulus. Aristobulus had a daughter, and his daughter married Peter when he was still Simon Peter. So that the wife of Aristobulus was the mother-in-law of St. Peter. The wife died and left Peter a misogynist, bitter against women. So that in the New Testament, when Jesus goes to Peter's house, the mother-in-law is ill, and Jesus heals her, and she immediately served them, because the wife had already died. It was just the mother-in-law that was left. Her husband was Aristobulus, who was a older brother to Cleophas, who was the father of St. Mark. So that all of them are related together. It's like a very large family. It has a radial quality to it in consciousness so that one can begin to understand. Anna had a daughter named Penarden who carried the mitochondrial DNA. She had three children by her husband, who was the chief of all of the fishing fleets of the Irish Sea. They had ports in Ireland, southern Scotland, Wales, and the west of Britain. And his name in Irish is spelled L-L-Y-R. In Irish Gaelic, it's spelled L-E-R. In Shakespeare, it's spelled L-E-A-R. In Scotland, it's spelled L-E-I-R, King Lear. He was the fisher king of the Irish Sea who married Anna's daughter, who would have been the granddaughter of one of the sisters of Jesus. You can find their stories in the great Welsh epic collection called the Mabinogion. Penarden's daughter married an Irish king who found out that the family had been severely compromised because Penarden was stolen from King Lear by a very powerful landowner who forced her to live with him from then on out and had two sons by her, and they were complete opposites. One was an evil radical, the other was an over-gentle milquetoast. But it left King Lear severely injured sexually and emotionally, so that he left that area of the Irish Sea and he went to Brittany in France, where he remarried and he had three daughters. And it's that story that Shakespeare tells in his greatest play, King Lear. All of this is not only traceable but confirmable in very odd ways, because all of a sudden peculiar things happen. They went to the west of Britain in 37 AD, and 6 years later the Roman Emperor Claudius, who came into power because the previous Roman Emperor named Caligula went absolutely crazy, terrorizing, and he finally was just simply murdered by everyone who had a sword. And Claudius came into power, and the first thing he did was to try to extend the Roman Empire in Britain. And the general in the south of Britain was Vespasian. And Vespasian was the first to make contact with the area that had just been given this gift of grace for that terrain. And the peculiar thing is that one traces Vespasian's career and finds that after all the Caesars were done, they were all finally killed, Nero being the last, Vespasian in 69 AD became the emperor of the Roman Empire and founded a new dynasty, the Flavian dynasty. He was acclaimed in Alexandria. And we'll see next week, it's exactly at the time that St. John is in Alexandria writing his gospel. Vespasian is acclaimed because they convinced him that he could do special kinds of miracles. He could take his spittoon and moisten dust and put it on the eyes of the blind and they could see. The crippled could touch the hem of his garment and they could walk. So that the miracles of Jesus are now transferred to Vespasian, and he was acclaimed emperor, and at the same time he then made sure that his oldest son Titus, who was in charge of the Roman legions in Judea, would for all time X out the Jewish heritage of some competitor to the miraculous new Flavian dynasty, and it is under Titus that Jerusalem and the temple are destroyed. It is Titus who builds the Arch of Titus in Rome. It's still there in the Foro Romano. And the big menorah from the temple in Jerusalem is placed there at the very center of the Arch of Titus. Titus had a mistress who was Jewish, who had been originally married to a very wealthy, very prominent Jewish man. His name was Marcus Julius Alexander. And Marcus Julius Alexander's father was named Gaius Julius Alexander for Gaius Julius Caesar, because the family had helped Julius Caesar in his Alexandrian War, and so the family that had carried the name Alexander since Alexander the Great's days added the middle name Julius, so they're all named something Julius Alexander. Marcus Julius Alexander married the daughter of Herod Agrippa. Berenice was her name. He was in charge of all the trading routes from Alexandria to India, down the Nile, across the Indian Ocean to the south of India. But he died, and Berenice went through a couple of very quick, very disappointing marriages that were all annulled, and she became the mistress of the Roman general Titus. And when Titus became Roman emperor, he thought very seriously about having a formal marriage, but could not bring himself to have a Jewish empress of the Roman Empire. And within a year, Titus died, and his younger brother, Domitian, became Roman emperor. And it's under Domitian that he slowly went the same way that the Caesars went. He became terrified existentially, and he became terrifying. And the last few years of his reign are called the Reign of Terror. And he's the one who singled out that it is the Jewish power that's still surviving in what are called Christians. And so he sent for and had the old Saint John brought to Rome to kill him in front of everyone to show that the Roman emperor has power. And they heated a large cauldron of oil and they threw in Saint John. He did not burn, nor did he die. And Domitian was beside himself with terror and decided that the worst thing that could happen then is to silence the man forever. So he exiled him to an island called Patmos. It's in the Aegean off the Turkish coast. Patmos is shaped like a ship, but it's of solid rock. There's almost nothing there. So he was exiled to a ship that could never move. And that's where the Apocalypse was written, on Patmos, in 95 AD. And when the Apocalypse, the Book of Revelation, was finished, Domitian fell dead. And the Flavian dynasty was over, like the Caesar dynasty was over. They brought in someone from Spain named Nerva, who for about a year fuddled around, and finally a very competent soldier named Trajan came into play and decided that if we just make the Christians look bad by having public trial after public trial, that they are a superstitious bunch, they do not believe in the gods that everyone believes in, we will be able to just finally X them out. When we come back next week, we'll see that all of this was dissolved in two other places that are cognate with Glastonbury. One of them certainly is Alexandria, and we'll take a look at that. But the other is in India, because it's in the south of India that St. Thomas was taken by that same trade route, that Jewish trade route. And it was in India that St. Thomas, who was an architect, by the way, just like Jesus' father, not just carpenters, they could build anything, including houses, boats. Thomas, when he got there, one of the kings realized that he was a great architect and wanted him to build a palace, so he gave him an incredible amount of money to buy the materials and time to do this. And after a couple of years, when he came to check, Thomas had given away all the money. He said, "I have built you a temple where it counts." The story goes on, but Thomas was finally spared, just like St. John. And it was Thomas who began the transform of Buddhism to the Mahayana. As the Mahayana, the great way, that's resonant with Jesus' way in Alexandria, resonant with what became the Arthurian ethos of the chivalric cycle of men who honor the truth and beauty of womanhood to carry the lineage of life if men will carry the torch of light. More next week.